everybody. How are you doing? My name is Alexis Scott, and I'm publisher of the Atlanta Daily World, and I am privileged to introduce our speaker this afternoon. And I'm so excited to see so many people and faces that I haven't seen in a long time, because my relationship with our speaker goes back to the Atlanta Journal and Constitution, and in fact goes back to the Atlanta Constitution before it was part of the Journal. And I'm going to read my script because I don't want to call him Johnny Huey. He might not speak if I call him that. But John Huey is Time Inc.'s sixth editor-in-chief. He took on that role in January of 2006, and he oversees the editorial content of approximately 150 magazines, including Time, Fortune, People, InStyle, Sports Illustrated, Entertainment Weekly, and Real Simple. He's also responsible for the editorial content of the company's websites and its brand extensions. And I hope he's going to share some of this activity with us, because it seems like it's impossible for one person to be in charge of all of that. But our paths first crossed when we were both young reporters at the Atlanta Constitution. And this was before the papers merged, as I said, and it was before cable, and it was before the internet. So in other words, it was a long time ago. Suffice it to say that I stayed and John left. He went on to work for the Wall Street Journal in Dallas and Atlanta, and in 1982, he moved to Brussels to help launch the journal's European edition and was its founding managing editor and later its editor. He is an Atlanta native and a graduate of the University of Georgia, and I like to tell people that we went to different schools together. I didn't go to the University of Georgia, but we graduated high school in the same year. He went on to conquer the world by working his way up the ladder at the Time Warner print empire after joining Fortune magazine in 1988. You can Google him for more information and more details. But besides, he has a limited time to be with us, so I don't want to talk any more about his brilliant career, and I would like for you to join me in welcoming John Huey as our speaker.
Thank you, Alexis. After reading Bo Emerson's article today, I don't know whether I should begin this speech by making chainsaw sounds, or which I can do, pretty good chainsaw, or by just saying, I feel good. So I'll go with I feel good. Sorry to inconvenience everybody. Most places I have spoken in the past, that fire alarm thing has worked, and I've just been able to go on without the lunch, and I didn't have any remarks. So now I got to kind of wing it. I was hoping that would do the trick, but Atlanta is used to adapting, so that failed. In New York, that would have ended the whole thing. We'd be done. I was actually brought here under false pretenses. I got a message asking me if I wanted to speak to the Atlanta Press Club from my assistant, and I said, no, thank you. Be polite, I do not. I continue to feel that way. However, the way I ended up here was then I later got a message that said, it's your old friend Alexis Scott's 10-year anniversary as the chairman, president, and publisher of the Atlanta Daily World. And it's very important to her that you come to this occasion to honor her. To which I said, well, I think I got to do that. That sounds right. So I wrote a little toast to Alexis and came down here. And then I learned a little while ago that wasn't really what the program was here. But I decided that I'm sticking with the program. So I'm gonna talk about, I'm not going to talk about the future of media. I'm not going to talk about platform agnostics. I'm going to talk about Alexis and me and a few other people in the room today. And I'd like to begin by talking about one of them briefly. I'd just like to thank One of them, for coming out here, I haven't seen him in many, many years. He's the person who got me into journalism for absolutely no good reason. I went in to see him looking for a job. He had a little one thing hanging on his wall. He had an old roll-top desk. There may or may not have been some liquor in it. We may or may not have had a drink of it. Your mind plays tricks on you when you look back. But there was a letter from Flannery O'Connor to him, and it said, "I really admire your work." And that was the only thing on the wall. And he asked me, "Did I have a resume?" And I said, "Well, no." And he said, "Oh, resumes, just a bunch of crap that people make up about themselves." And I said, "Yeah, I couldn't agree more." And he asked me if I'd gone to journalism school. And I said, "No, I'm an English major." And he said, "Well, I thought journalism school was just a vocational school. I don't know why business." And I thought, this interview is going pretty well for a guy with absolutely no credentials, no prospects, no job. And it was during a recession. And for reasons known only to him, he hired me as a reporter, editor, writer at the DeKalb New Era, and we had a motto there, sort of a we ran the place by the put up model. He put up with a lot from his staff, and we put up with a lot from him as an owner. And he's here today. His name is Britt Fasu, and I just would like to thank him for hiring me all those years ago. For coming out to see me. So I don't know, maybe you should stand up, Britt. I know you don't like to do that, but wherever you are, just stand up. Thank you. As usual, he's in the back, in the corner. But I thought he was a great newspaper man, and to answer Bo Emerson's questions, most of what I learned there. A lot of it I had to forget later in order to survive. But Alexis and me, we are... Unlike most people in the room, with a couple of exceptions, most notably Art Harris, who has a whole nother story that if I get into that, it'll just, the digression will eat the speech. So with the exception of Art Harris, Alexis and I are two of the rare Atlanta natives, and we are really natives of Atlanta, and our families go back before us. And I was born in 1948 at Emory Hospital. She was born in 1949 at a small private all-black hospital. My grandfather was born out in Decatur in 1853, and my father was born in Atlanta in 1897. You do the math. I have business cards at home that were printed in the late 1890s that say, "John Huey and Son, 11 Piedmont Avenue, practical blacksmiths, horseshoeing wagon and buggy repair." Now, 11 Piedmont Avenue, if you think about it, is right around the corner from Auburn Avenue, where Alexis's grandfather, W.A. Scott, in 1932, founded the first black-owned daily newspaper in 20th century America. Right around the corner, right by Big Bethel and Ebenezer Baptist Church and the Royal Peacock Lounge and the old Jenkins Steakhouse. And so my family was known for its shrewd real estate instincts. My father, for instance, when he read a story in the 30s that they were building the Fox Theater, declared that it would never work because they were putting it out too far for anybody to ever go to it. True story. He owned another business years later, right after World War II, called the Imperial Body Works. And that was right around the corner from Auburn Avenue, again, on Piedmont Avenue, and right next to that motel where the Royal Peacock performers all stayed. So I think Alexis and I kind of grew up in the same neighborhood. We just didn't know it. And we came into the same world at the same time. But except we really didn't. We came into two completely different worlds. She was a patrician. She went to Barnard College, Columbia University. Her family was prominent, historically important. I went to the UGA. My family was salt of the earth. She graduated class valedictorian from Booker T. Washington High School. I graduated from North Fulton High School. One thing we had in common, because we went to public high school in Atlanta at the same time, is we both listened to Ralph McGill on the radio once a week. We had this old newspaper editor who came on the radio, and we listened to him, and he talked about really only one thing, which was moderation, you know, and integration, and it's coming, and you should live with it. It's okay. It's a good thing. It's not the end of the world. And we all listened to it, and then we moved on. But the most important distinction between Alexis and me at the time was, of course, that she was black and I was white. And at that time, that was a huge distinction. To tell you a story to demonstrate, one class before ours, 1965, once in a little amateur research project, I thought I knew who the best athletes of my generation were, the best high school athletes. I went to, I knew the football players. I wasn't one. I knew the train. We all had our legends. But I knew that a particular person had gone to Atlanta High School, and I knew I'd never heard of him. So I went back and checked the morgue, as they used to call it, before Google, in the Atlanta newspaper to see how many times he had been mentioned in the Atlanta newspaper. And he was mentioned once for being the quarterback who led David T. Howard High School to the all-black championship. And he was mentioned once more for signing a grant and aid to the University of Southern Illinois to play basketball. And the item was about that big, and it ran down in the lower corner. That was Walt Frazier, who went on to win a couple of NBA championships and is today the voice of the Knicks and is without a doubt the best athlete of my generation to come out of Atlanta. But nobody I knew ever heard of him. I think Alexis probably had heard of him. Now, you got to remember, this was after Brown versus Board of Education, which was 54. It was after the Public Accommodations Bill of 64. It was after the Voting Rights of 1965. The laws had passed, but we still lived in two completely different Atlantas. And you fast forward a little bit to 1970 when I graduated from the University of Georgia, and I made this point at a pretty thrilling moment for me, which was giving the graduation speech at the University of Georgia. The only reason it was thrilling to me was I was in the middle of the field in Sanford Stadium, and I had everybody's attention. Now, for a brief moment, everybody dreams of that, right? And I told them, I said, when I graduated from this school in 1970, I can't help but think, standing here in the house that Herschel built, there wasn't a single African-American athlete on a single team at the University of Georgia in 1970, many, many, many years after all this stuff. So 1970, I come into journalism a few years later. Alexis and I began our journalism career, the early beginnings had another thing in common. I was working at the DeKalb New Era. She obviously found some work at the Daily World when she needed it, I suppose. But we were both, because Atlanta was the kind of place that had a national story, which was the Civil Rights Movement. There were a lot of national media here in town, and one of them was Newsweek. And she was hired by Joe Cumming and Vern Smith and Eleanor Cliff to work in the Newsweek Bureau. I was a stringer in the Newsweek Bureau. They hired me, too. Except the difference in her experience and my experience was they took me out to lunch, and Joe Cumming told me, and he and I have discussed this since, but he told me, actually the quote was, you should get out of journalism. You just don't get it. So, which explains part of how I ended up at Time. And why I'm very motivated at Time to this day. Time moves on, and Alexis and I find ourselves in the same little newsroom at the Atlanta Constitution. And it's a very important distinction she made there about the Atlanta Constitution. We were the Atlanta Constitution, by God. We were not the Atlanta Journal. Charlie Hazlett worked at the Atlanta Journal. People like Charlie Hazlett worked at the Atlanta Journal. I'd known him since college. We were the Atlanta Constitution. We were pretty rare. There were. We like to think it was the glory days. I figured it out recently. In the newsroom, there were 30 reporters. And 10 of them were impaired one way or another. And were usually off doing other things. And another 10 were the kind you could count on to sort of bring in the regular whatever needed. And then there were another 10 of all of us. We all thought very highly of ourselves. We had Hal Raines, who was the entertainment tabloid editor and movie reviewer. Very arrogant little guy, as I remember. There was Art Harris, who had a giant afro. I kid you not. I'm not making this up. He looked like Jimi Hendrix, Have You Ever Been Experienced there. And the crackers that ran the paper hated him so much that they put him on the copy desk. So we had this Afro Jewish character on the copy desk who was always trying to get out and write gonzo entertainment stories, which he did. And he was the only person there. I've been friends with Art ever since, because when I went there, I said, "Where's my desk?" And they said, "You don't get a desk, you get a drawer." I said, "Well, where's my drawer?" They showed me my drawer. I said, "Well, where am I supposed to type?" And they said, "You just wait till somebody gets up and then you use their desk and wait until they come back." And Art actually offered me his typewriter on regular. He said, you can use my desk. I'm going to the clubs tonight to do this." Covering city politics, we had Rick Allen, who is all the way here from Bozeman, Montana. And he had grown up in Bronxville. And we all agree that he was the whitest white boy we had ever met. And the joke in the newsroom was that the first black person he'd ever met was Maynard Jackson, who he covered. And did a pretty good job looking back on it all, I got to say. And as I say, we had a cast of characters. But it wasn't exactly Ralph McGill's newspaper. For example, there was a period there where my boss was the features editor, and his name was Louis Grizzard. And he was an unusual fellow to work for. Art will remember this story. Art goes down to Macon. He breaks the story that Greg Allman is marrying Cher. And he takes a picture of him in this bar in Macon, and he comes back. This is a funny story, but it's not a happy story, so I'm trying to figure out exactly how to tell it. He comes back, and he has a picture of Greg and Cher and another woman who I don't know who it was, but she was blonde, and J-Mo, who was the black drummer for the Allman Brothers, J. Johnny Johansson. And Louis Grizzard said, I kid you not, "We got to get him out of the picture. My old granny would turn over in her grave, him sitting there like that with a white girl." And by God, they got him out of the picture. They airbrushed his ass right out of there. Which put me in mind of an old Joe South song, "These Are Not My People." And that was about the time I decided I had to get out of there. I wrote mostly about murders and politics of a lower order. They had me covering Republican politics in Georgia because they knew it would never amount to anything. And I would write about people like Machine Gun Ronnie Thompson, and there would be no consequences. And Alexis, so they had me over there, and they had Alexis on that most prosaic of beats that they always give the girl from Barnard, education, which we all bemoan, but nobody wants to read about. But lo and behold, they have the strike and the teacher's strike, and I get to work with her, which means I get to go hang out at Pascal's La Carousel, which I had always wanted to hang out, but, you know, it wasn't my place. But it was her place. And we went out there, and they had me. I just sat there to make sure nobody went out the back door. She had all the sources. She had all the story. And we got to know each other a little bit during that period. And I thought about it, and preparing this toast, which is what this is, that Alexis was, she was my window for the first time to that other Atlanta that had been all around me all that time, and I didn't know anything about it. And I realized, not so much then, but I realize now, that we were really there at an extraordinary time in history. It It didn't seem so at the time because it was pretty calm. But we were two sides of the same Atlanta coin, Alexis and me. We had instant recognition. As she said, we went together to different schools. We could compare notes. Everything added up. And at the very moment that we met and got to know each other, the coin was being flipped in the air, everything was turning over in Atlanta. Maynard had been elected, and that was one thing. Everybody accepted that pretty well. Chamber of Commerce worked that out pretty well. But when he named Reggie Eves, his old college roommate, to be the police chief, oh my. Did that mean black people would be arresting white people? Oh my, my, my. This is a whole different thing. So we went through this period that was quite extraordinary, and one of the great stories of that time, I don't know how many of you remember it. I know Rick and Art and Charlie remember. We had two police chiefs in Atlanta. We had a black police chief and we had a white police chief who refused to leave his office because he was the white police chief and he wasn't going anywhere. So that went on interminably, and we covered both of them, and they were all in the same building, and it was just really pretty wacky. And the only thing I remember about it is we were all kind of amused by it. But you look at it now, you think, well, that sounds a little bit like Pakistan. But but it didn't really feel that way. It was a great story. And you got to remember, we had grown up just to remind you of where we came from. I mean, when we grew up in Atlanta, Highway 41, we called the four lane. that was, our idea of a skyscraper was this bank building down here. I don't know what is it now? It was the Fulton National Bank when they built it, and we thought it was really something. And I remember going over, my father had a field where Piedmont Road crosses I-85. Of course, he got rid of it long before that happened. And sometime I'll tell you about the land my mother used to have next to Callaway Gardens, too. We went over and watched them blow up the rocks because they were building a free expressway. We didn't know what an expressway was. We'd never seen one. I remember riding with my kids on a bike over to see them tear down Mr. Otley's house because they were going to build a mall there, and we didn't know what a mall was, and we wanted to know what a mall was. Lenox Square. They built it. We said, okay, that's what it was. And it had a trampoline park in it. So we were kind of ignorant. I mean, we were not an international city. Except I remember when the first pizza came to Atlanta. It was a Marty Busso or Franco, depending on who you – Art and I argue about this a lot. But anyway, looking back on that little period, I realized that most of us were really just boys and girls. And Alexis was a grown-up. She was already – this coin was flipping, and she was gonna take the mantle. She was the best looking, most well spoken, most well mannered of the bunch. And when the coin came down out of the air and finally landed on heads after all those years on tails, she became one of the city's great civic leaders. And I mean, I was looking over this list of stuff she's done. It's just amazing. But she, alongside Maynard and Andy and Shirley Franklin, and I have to say, I got to have a little shout out here for Cynthia Tucker, because everybody talks about Ralph McGill and Gene Patterson. The next editor to win a Pulitzer Prize after them is Cynthia, and I'm a big fan of hers. She deserves this Pulitzer Prize. She's got a lot of courage. She writes great. She reflects this city the way it is. So I'd say Cynthia and Alexis, you listen to these things Alexis has done. I mean, I'm not going to read the whole thing. I got this. It's unbelievable. Been chair of the succession plan. It just goes on and on and on. She's the chairman of everything, and she's a true civic leader. And she saved the family newspaper. So I guess we don't have time for that because of that fire drills prank. But anyway, you all know her. You know what she is. So this story has a happy ending. She became a great civic leader. I got out of town, which was good for me and the town. And the two Atlantas disappeared, and the one Atlanta thrived and comes together. But, you know, I was thinking about it, what's the trade-off for all this? Atlanta's this big city now. In metropolitan Atlanta, there are twice as many people today in metropolitan Atlanta as there are in the whole state of South Carolina. I mean, it's pretty scary. And the national press had flocked here in the 60s to cover the civil rights movement, which was great for people like me and a lot of other people in the room because we learned about the media, we learned all that. But they were here to cover Martin Luther King and the Oasis in the Deep South. Now, you know, the good news is Atlanta's no longer an eccentric two Atlanta cities with all that, two police departments, all that. But what now, it's really just another big city. And if you make it in the national news, the stories are going to be about water, traffic. Congratulations, Time Magazine just named you in a tie this week as second in traffic, second only to Los Angeles. You're tied with San Francisco and Houston, maybe somewhere. And a well-deserved award. Air quality. On the water thing, I mean, I got no business butting in on this, but not as a journalist, but just as a private citizen. I'm sure it occurred to you the way it occurred to me many times that as this building exploded, you look at the Chattahoochee River and you go, I don't think there's enough water in there for all this. It's just... I was just guessing. I didn't go to tech. I didn't measure any of that. But I don't think you had to go to tech to figure out that there wasn't enough water in the Chattahoochee River to take care of 5 million people, especially when there's a golf course for every 1,000 of them, you know, and you got to water the grass. So the restaurants are better. The arts are better. The opportunities are better. Falcons still suck. That's good. That keeps... Nothing's changed there. They're still the most embarrassing team in professional sports. But I got to say, I don't want to sound politically incorrect, but the era Alexis and I grew up in couldn't have been more interesting or exciting as people who were interested in journalists and social progress. And so as I say, it had a happy ending, but I have a little bit of nostalgia for it. And I find it, it's probably the mark of being an old man, but I find it more interesting than a lot of the domestic stories that I look at today, because important things were happening and you knew what they were and you were kind of a part of it. So that's my toast to Alexis Scott for staying here and saving this great newspaper and being such a wonderful leader in Atlanta. And thanks for having me down here. Now that it's over, I've enjoyed it. And I have one other little plug. You know, I grew up next door to this little kid who was always selling hot dogs out in the front yard. And he made it good, Tommy Murphy of Murphy's Deli over in Virginia Highland. And you want this book because there's a great quote from me on it in page 10. Against my better judgment, I will take questions. But I got to tell you, in the world of Gawker and Romanesco and Jossop and all that, your chances of getting a straight answer are slim to none. In the old days, I would have told you, but now, you know. So ask away if you want to know anything.
Okay, let's see if we can squeeze a few in. If anybody's got cards, bring them up here. Somebody you wrote about as a reporter, Roberto Goizueta, tried to instill a culture of intelligent risk-taking when he was CEO at Coke. You took a big risk when you quit a secure job to found South Point Magazine. What lessons did you learn from that?
Well, I learned one lesson from that, and I tell everybody, periodically people come to me and they want to start a regional magazine, and they have light in their eyes, and I always tell them, kid, you came to the wrong guy. These things don't work. Don't do it. But I'm not sure it's a universal lesson. Somebody will overcome that. But what I learned from that was timing. On the one hand, timing is everything. On the other hand, sometimes things that seem like a great idea at the time, maybe they weren't such a great idea. had a lot of fun, though.
As an ex-Wall Street Journal reporter, what do you think of Rupert Murdoch's purchase of Dow Jones?
Well, I think it was inevitable. I think it will mark significant change for the journal, not necessarily all bad, in fact, quite possibly some for the good, and it will the journal will continue to be the I think the primary source that most business people go to for information. I mean, one thing you got to remember about the Wall Street Journal and their readership, you know, it's not a pack of liberals to begin with. So I think the liberal press's outcry is more about them than it is about the people who actually read the Wall Street Journal. I mean, they've been reading those editorials for a long time. They're not real left-wing. But I think that the reason it's inevitable is because the business had become so challenged in its current ownership, and somebody had to buy it. And frankly, I'm glad it was bought by somebody who loves newspapers, as opposed to some private equity guy who wants to flip it and take a lot of money out of it. Rupert will put money into it. The journal will last a long time, and it'll be a hell of an interesting story, and for the right people, a really interesting place to work. It's not necessarily all the same people who work there now, but...
Why is there no masthead in news magazines such as Time and Newsweek?
There is, but it runs periodically, and it runs when it fits into the advertising edit ratio, and when that is challenged, it doesn't run. I'm curious to hear that people think there's no masthead, because it does run fairly often. And the last time I checked, I was still on it. That's how I know. That's how I know it's in there. It's the first thing I do. I open it up, turn, and see if I'm still there. So I'm a little disturbed. Maybe I need to look at the latest issue. I've been on the road for a while.
Why did Time magazine get rid of James Steele, the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer?
Who? Who? Oh, Barlett and Steele? You know, that's a long, complicated, private, personnel story that nothing has benefited from discussing anymore. It's been discussed a lot in a lot of places. But I wish them well, and they're thriving at Vanity Fair. People, in this business, people move for all kinds of reasons.
How do your magazines make sure that what they report is accurate? And this, the question is because...
Wikipedia. I'm kidding. We still have a fairly elaborate fact-checking system. We've just put more of the burden of the fact-checking on the actual gatherer of the information, and in particularly sensitive stories, we're still able to bring the whole red check apparatus to bear. Every story is read by at least one lawyer. Many stories are read by me personally. We do everything we can, but mistakes do get made in any business, including brain surgery. Fortunately, we don't kill anybody, usually.
The question says, I once heard you were, you say you were always looking for an excuse to put Roberto Goizueta or Andy Grove on the cover of Fortune because it increased newsstand sales by about 50,000. Is that still true? Who helps newsstand sales these days? And given the advent of the internet, how have the dynamics of marketing and selling magazines changed?
Well, 50,000 is an exaggeration for Roberto. In my days as editor of Fortune, the people who sold that magazine were Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Andy Grove, Goizueta, Jack Welch, and who?
Buffett.
Buffett, yeah. Very good. Thank you, Maria. Buffett and we, you know, we called it the Pantheon. There's another magazine we own called Uncut, that's an old-time rock and roll magazine. They have their pantheon. They only run the Grateful Dead, Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, you know. Who sells today? It depends on what magazine you're talking about. I mean, I'm hoping Brad Pitt sells people because, not Brad, Matt Damon, because he's on the cover right now as the sexiest man alive. So that would be a good sign that we think he'll sell. You know, personalities really don't sell news weeklies much, and they don't sell business magazines so much anymore. Business magazines are more sold by ideas or access to a particular point of view on something. There aren't many newsstand business celebrities in the world right now. They all went into hiding after 2001, and they haven't come back. Most companies today, their PR strategy really is they really don't even want you to know they exist. So they kind of stay down. In the sports world, it's, you know, the obvious people. Peyton Manning and Tom Brady and people who win. There was a time when Michael Vick was good on the cover, in spite of not winning, but that time is over.
How do you determine in a national magazine if a regional or local story is worthy of coverage?
Judgment. You use your judgment. Same way you determine how you run something on the front page of the Atlanta Constitution or what you're going to put on the cover of Atlanta Magazine. The reason they're paying you to be the editor is you're supposed to have judgment about those things, and that judgment is supposed to tell you what the reader wants. It's supposed to be about, what do you think that, after you go through all the sturm and drang of the writer and the editor and everything, you're supposed to ask the question, gee, what do you think the reader wants? And then you give the reader what they want. Now, a lot of writers call that pandering, but I think it's really what you're there for.
How did you go on with your life after losing Rick Riley at Sports Illustrated?
That would be one of those questions that if I answered it, any way I answer it, it'll end up on one of the aforementioned places that we talked about. So I'm just going to pretend like you didn't ask me that question and move on.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you oversee so many publications and what your role is in doing that, how hands-on you are?
Well, the truth is, of all the big number of magazines that they have, a lot of them are in groups that are run by businesses like, say, Southern Progress in Birmingham, where I have a very limited role. I mean, I have some role. I was over there last week looking at some things they're doing just because ultimately I'm responsible for it, but I'm not over there like moving the turkey over this way for the Thanksgiving shoot or saying, I don't think those buttercups are the right buttercups because I rarely do that. I suppose I could, but so those people, we have a nice relationship. The magazines that I'm more involved with are the big titles in New York, that like Time, Sports Illustrated, People, Fortune, Money, In Style, Real Simple. And those magazines, the managing editors of them work for me, and we work together, and we talk on an almost daily basis about what they're doing, what their problems are, and I try to help them with their problems, and they... And I give them my opinions on things. Sometimes they listen to them, sometimes they don't. But it's just a day in and day out relationship with them. I'm very interested in what goes on the covers. That's interests me a lot. But I'm mostly interested in who's running the magazines and are their staffs, comfortable with their leadership and performing well. I'm not that hands on an editor anymore, which I miss, but...
How do you think your life would have been different if you had been born black in Atlanta at the same time?
Well, I think it would have been very different. Like, I can't imagine it being more different. I think the best way to answer that is, I think I would have been thankful to have been born in Atlanta, as because I think it turned out to be a city with a lot of interesting opportunity, and it's a place that, since the end of the Civil War, had a history of educating black people, and Rockefeller came down here and paid for a lot of it, and that's kind of unusual. It didn't happen in a lot of other places in the South or the North. And there was a black entrepreneurial class here and a black educational class here. And so I guess first question is I would have to ask is, would I be born into that class, or would I be born somewhere else in Buttermilk Bottoms? And I don't know. And that would have made it. But even so, I would like to. I think I would have had a more opportunity to latch on to that phenomenon and figure it out. And it would have been much harder. Is the real answer? Much harder. My life was pretty damned easy, to be honest, and I think it would have been a lot harder.
With so many niche magazines in the market, is there any subject or area that you think should have its own publication and doesn't?
I don't think about that very much because we're a mass market company, and we have, in recent years, we've been selling most of our niche magazines. So if there are niches out there, and there are, they'll get their magazines, but it's not really, that's not what my job is all about. Large numbers of people. Like, I think People Magazine has 45 million readers. So, you know, we're bigger than networks. We're a mass market publishing company, and we're very much focused on that these days. So that'd be a better question for another kind of publisher.
What role is the internet playing in your publications today? Is it different for each entity, or do you have an overall strategy?
Obviously, the internet looms huge in our business, and it looms huge in every publishing business and every content business. And we have an overall strategy, but the overall strategy accommodates the differences in the magazines. I mean, obviously, InStyle's internet strategy would be different from Time Magazine's internet strategy, but our strategy is to migrate our brands. This is the part I promised I wouldn't talk about in the speech, to migrate our brands to that platform agnostic world where all branded content is already living. And we're quite successful at it, but we got a long way to go. Our big online successes are SportsIllustrated.com, CNNMoney.com, which incorporates all the business books, and People.com is probably our fastest growing, and Time.com is in a very competitive rebuild and repositioning against all kinds of competitors in the news space, and our service books, Southern Progress, is coming on strong with their internet strategy. So the answer to that is yes and yes, we devote an enormous amount of time and energy and talent to that question.
John.
And the money now is real. It's no longer, we've been in it a long time. I mean, Pathfinder, which everyone laughs at us about, but the only reason it was so laughable is because we were first. We were out there way before anybody else. And in the publishing industry, we're way ahead of the rest of the publishing industry. The problem is we're not just competing with the publishing industry anymore. Here's an interesting statistic, and you have to check the market today to make sure it's still true. But last week, the market cap of Google exceeded the market cap of all these companies combined. Time Warner, Disney, News Corp, both Viacoms. And if you wanted to, you could throw in New York Times, Dow Jones, but that's a rounding error, wouldn't it? But the entire media business doesn't have a market cap as big as Google.
This looks like a good question to end on. What do you want to do when you grow up?
I think about that a lot these days. I think I just want to have more fun. I've had a lot of fun, but I like to keep the fun coming. Thanks a lot for listening. It's good to be back.
Thank you for coming today, John. The Press Club would like to show its appreciation by making a donation to your favorite charity. And to everyone here, we hope to see you at our next Newsmaker Luncheon, December 6th. That's going to be Tom Brokaw. You may have heard of him, former anchor and managing editor of NBC Nightly News. And our 15th annual holiday author party will be at the New World of Coca-Cola on December 5th. Don't forget to become a member of the Press Club or renew your membership. And for more information on upcoming events, visit our website at atlantapressclub.org. Thanks for coming.